You're listening to CITR 101.9 FM, and this is The Real World. The Real World is the UBC Film Society's radio segment where we talk about all things film related. And we're on every other Thursday from 4 to 5 p.m. So, yeah, this is an on week. If you tuned in a couple weeks ago, we had our Fun Drive special. I'm Lily, as usual. I'm joined by
Emma.
And this week, we're joined by a super special guest, Mia.
Hi.
You want to introduce yourself? Any like fun facts?
Okay, I'm Mia. I'm a second year student. I'm also Lily's roommate. I don't know if we're disclosing that kind of information.
That would take a personal turn. I'm going to stop you right there. My fun fact about Mia is that Mia was the one to introduce me to Letterboxd. I had no idea what Letterboxd was until last year. How long have you had it, Emma? Just break the news to me.
Probably, I would have to say, a year and a half, probably not very long.
Okay, so you're not that ahead of me.
I beat you both.
How long have you had it?
I've had it since
the start. They kind of.
I was one of the original creators, actually. I was on the board.
There's like video game testers, and then he has
black and white blurry footage of me kind of coding in the back.
flawless_Lily is my username Letterboxd. Please go follow my Letterboxd. I write really great reviews. But just before we kick off our episode, I want to give a couple film sock updates. So keep your eye out on at UBC Film Society's Instagram, where most of our updates come. And we don't just have a radio show. We post all of our weekly double features that we're going to have and any other film-related campus events that we're hosting on our Instagram. So tonight we have a science fiction double feature at 6 p.m. We're screening Neptune Frost and Born in Flames at 8 p.m. This is all in the Norm Theater, which is in the Life Building on UBC's campus. Okay, before we get into this episode, we're going to get started with a couple ads. So we'll be right back.
MRG Live is happy to present Anomaly with his live band at the Wise Hall on Saturday, February 24th, with support from Blue Wednesday. Anomaly has toured his electro jazz project all over the world, but this February, the Montreal-based artist embarks on a full Canadian tour for the very first time. Come out to experience the innovative fusion of electronic beats, jazz harmonies, and funky grooves from the one and only Anomaly, live in concert with his band. Don't miss Anomaly at the Wise Hall in Vancouver on February 24th, 2024. Tickets are on sale now at admitone.com.
The Association of Canadian Archivists student chapter at UBC is happy to announce their 15th annual student-led conference taking place on February 16th with the theme Archives and the Environment, Land, Colonialism, and the Climate Crisis. This virtual event will reflect and discuss the responsibility of the archivist in the time of climate crisis and how archival records play into reparative justice for colonial brutalities. This is free to attend for students, and registration can be found at www.acasymposium.arts.ubc.ca. No matter where you are on February 16th, virtually join this vital student-led conference happening from 9 a.m. to 4:30 p.m. PST.
Feeling lost in the lonely, meaningless cyber web? Looking to connect with other users? Then plug in to a CITR collective. Meet users who are compatible with your interests and passions. CITR's mainframe offers 9 unique collectives: news, arts, accessibility, sports, persons of color, indigenous, gender empowerment, LGBTQ2SIA+, and music affairs. CITR collectives are where you can make great radio, great friends, and avoid the abject loneliness of life in the cyber void.
Loneliness. Old or New Testament?
I think the New Testament.
The question is, Pilot, remember Pilot from the New Testament?
Not just Pilot, he fiddled while...
Yeah, no, well, just a minute. Let me ask the question, then you can give me the answer, okay? Did Pilate want Jesus to be crucified?
Pontius Pilate washed his hands of it.
So did he want him to be crucified?
Yeah.
No. No. No.
Well, tune in every Friday afternoon, 3:30 to the Night Watch Show on Sunya!
Well, find a good church. It'll help you.
That was crazy. Okay, that was Nardwar, our biggest fan. We can't say that we're his biggest fan. Who am I kidding? Okay, anyway. So last week for Fun Drive, like I said, we did a trivia-themed episode, and a lot of it related to money because it was a fundraiser, but also like proposals on screen and things like that, because that was kind of the theme of Fun Drive. So this week we're kind of doing a little bit of a trend. We promise we're gonna take a break from this type of conversation in following episodes, but because it's the week of Valentine's Day, happy Valentine's Day everyone, it was yesterday, our episode, we're gonna do a little bit of talk on romantic genres, not just rom-coms. We've also got like period romance and romantic drama, a mix of a couple things, so that it's not too much of the same. But the first movie I wanted to talk about is called It Happened One Night. Have you guys seen this one?
I have not.
Okay, well, basically, the reason I wanted to start off with just a little bit about this movie is because, from what I know, it kind of became the blueprint for like a lot of the common tropes that we might be talking about later in the episode. So It Happened One Night came out in 1934. It was directed by Frank Capra. So this is the same director who did It's a Wonderful Life, which we talked about on a previous episode. And it stars Clark Gable and Claudette Colbert. Clark Gable's my new crush, by the way, if anyone's wondering. Anyway, It Happened One Night became the first film... Oh, yeah, this is a good question for you guys.
Oh, no.
It did the...
I can't go back!
Back to Fun Drive quizzing. You killed that. I don't know why you're acting like this right now. It was the first film ever. It Happened One Night. Not only was it the blueprint for a lot of romance movies, but the first clean sweep of the major five Oscar categories.
Oh, my gosh.
Which are?
Best Picture.
Okay.
Yeah. Best Actor?
Yeah.
Best... Actress?
Yeah.
Set design?
Yeah.
No.
Director?
Yeah.
Supporting?
What's the last one?
What's the number five?
Editing. Soundtracks.
Best supporting actress. No, I'm just kidding. I was like, there's no way they would let that get into the major five. It's best screenplay.
Oh.
But yeah, I thought, geez, so impressive. Basically, the plot, since you guys haven't seen it, it's like very generic, like it sounds like every other rom-com, kind of. Unlikely pairing. The working man and the rich woman. She's an heiress, by the way. She's like engaged to meet someone called King Wesley.
Okay.
They meet on a bus when she's fleeing her controlling rich father. She's trying to get to King Wesley, but she meets Clark Gable's character, Peter, on the bus from Florida to New York, but they end up missing one of the, at the stop with the bus, and then the bus leaves them behind. So they're stuck together, unfortunately.
Oh, no.
I know.
How they cope?
And they have to like share motel rooms and
like actual worst nightmare. Hate when that happens.
They can't catch a break. But it was kind of considered like a big blueprint for a lot of romantic comedies to come. And we can't really say that it's like the first ever rom-com. But it has been used in reference, like, as a template for them time and time again. So it had the common theme of something called comedies of manners, which was a really common trope back then where it's, like, a rich woman and a poor guy getting together.
How it should be.
Yeah. And which I thought was kind of interesting. I guess that was a thing of the times because they were trying to promote in theaters, like, noble men and, like, humble men were the way to go and... just being kind of admirable. They don't have to be so flaunty. And then it was also credited for the first screwball comedy, which I don't know if that's like a subgenre you guys are into, but it's known for like really fast and quippy dialogue. It's like sarcastic, which it's kind of like fizzled out a little bit, I guess, because it's just not required anymore. Because a big part of why like screwball comedy was a huge thing apparently was because of all the codes that were in place when this movie was being filmed and like all the other screwball comedies where they like weren't allowed to like actually have sex.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
All that stuff. So it was basically all of the sexual alluding and like innuendos had to be in what wasn't done. So it's very dialogue heavy. It's like quippy, sarcastic, flirty, but they can't like touch each other. They can't have sex. They can't do anything that's like related to anything that's considered in this code as like inappropriate. So profanity, they can't do drugs, anything like that, basically. So that's fizzled out because I guess like this code is obviously not in place anymore. But we still see like that kind of pattern being followed. Like I was thinking about Meg Ryan and Billy Crystal in When Harry Met Sally. Like it's very sarcastic, mm-hmm, back and forth, bickering, like that type of thing. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it's got every trope in the book, which I think will be good with whatever movies we talk about later. Enemies to lovers. They hate each other. They hate each other in this film. Fake dating. Two people, one motel room, all of those types of things. Okay, yeah, I hate to reference this, but I also love to reference this. Anyone But You.
I know, I was about to say that. I was like,
Have you seen it?
Oh, God, have I seen it?
Anyone But You, it just came out. It's Glenn Powell and Sydney Sweeney.
I have not.
Okay, you don't need to.
No, you do need to.
That's the thing. I hate talking about it, but I love talking about it. You don't need to see it, but literally go see it the first chance you get.
But it was re-debuted in theaters for this week, Valentine's.
Yeah.
This is your chance.
Take it or leave it. Like,
hop on that, yeah. Mm-hmm.
You'll never get a chance like this again. So yeah, it's like the fake dating thing and what's so attractive about it, which is like why I think, honestly, like one point to Anyone But You for kind of playing along with this trope, because I do like it. I get it. Like that... the interest is that it's kind of sexy in what they're not doing. They're flirty because they're not doing anything. They like hate each other. Like it's a charged scene, mm-hmm, but just through like talking, which I think is impressive, honestly. Like it's not like they're actually doing anything inappropriate on screen. So yeah, like they have that, all of that kind of stuff in It Happened One Night. He does like a striptease kind of thing, which was kind of going against the code, but they were able to get around it because it was like 4 months before the code was like extremely put into place where you would get fined $25,000. So they just slipped that stuff in there.
Good for them.
But I think it's a good movie to talk about, especially with like, there's a lot of conversation of like, where are all the good romance movies going, especially like rom-com specifically, like bring back the rom-com. I don't know. People are claiming when rom-coms are coming out that it's either just subscribing to the thing that rom-coms are fizzling out or it revived them all at once.
Yeah.
But yeah, if you guys haven't seen it, I think that you should. And the next movie we're going to talk about is a change in pace, because it's not just, like I was talking about, the actions that aren't actually happening. Like they couldn't actually have sex, they couldn't actually kiss or anything like that. But the next movie we're going to talk about is a different turn. It's words that aren't spoken, which is my transition into In the Mood for Love, which I think is kind of known a lot for words unspoken and like feelings conveyed through the cinematography and through their facial expressions and body language and not actually what they feel they can say to each other.
Yeah.
We've all seen this,
mm-hmm, yeah.
Because it just played at the UBC Film Society's Beer Garden.
Shout out.
Hell yeah.
But yeah, what are first reactions? I know Mia had already seen it. It's been in your top four on Letterboxd before, but right now.
I know, it's not there right now, but I really do have like an attachment to that movie. I love that movie. So I was really glad to get to see it on the big screen because I never had before.
Never?
On the big screen? Yeah, no.
How many times? Okay. How many times have you seen it before?
Like once or twice, but I've only logged it once on Letterboxd.
Okay, so you've only seen it once.
Okay.
Answer the question straight. And then this was our first time seeing it, mine and Emma's first time.
Yeah, and this is like the first Wong Kar-wai movie I've ever seen.
Okay,
well.
Me too.
So this is like, you know, great little film
stuff. Yeah, I was supposed to watch Chungking Express in... Yeah.
Oh, I was about to say, you literally were supposed to watch it for... film studies.
I skipped that week.
That was the biggest mistake in your life.
I know, and I really regretted it. I really did. And I still plan to see that movie. But I'm glad that I saw this In the Mood for Love as my introduction to Wong Kar-wai, because after sitting on it more, I've had time to digest it. Because my immediate reactions, as Mia heard,
I bared witness to more like
she almost kicked me out of the house after that.
It was a tense bus ride home, let's just say that.
But yeah, I've sat on it more. I like it more. But before I give my first reactions, why don't you hit it off with yours, Emma?
I really liked it. Like, just visually, it's such a pretty movie. The soundtrack, like, mm-hmm. It all plays out in such a, like, beautifully tragic sort of way. That's all, like, it's so contained, but, like, expansive, if that makes sense. Like, it has very few sort of locations that kind of bounces between, very few major supporting characters, but it's still, you really get a sense of, like, the scope of this world that they inhabit, despite all of that, which I think was really well done.
Mm-hmm. The sets were beautiful, like, just, like, the shots in hallways or door frames. It's all kind of felt like you were, it was very intimate in the way that you felt like you were peeking in on their lives. Nothing like these other rom-coms that I've already, like, referenced and stuff like mm-hmm. that, where you're very removed from it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But this was, like, it almost felt a little bit wrong because, like, you're mm-hmm. seeing them in reflections of mirrors. You really, I don't know, that's how I felt. Like, yeah. It felt, like, a little bit wrong to see it because I was peeping in on something. Exactly. But still, that it helps mm-hmm. the experience as a viewer to, like, feel so close to them.
Yeah. I love the intimacy of being able to see them through, like, reflective shots mm-hmm. because mm-hmm. they don't really interact that much romantically on yeah. screen, like you were saying, like, with the kind of, like, historical codes and stuff where people had to work around innuendos, but this was done purposefully.
Yeah.
Where you're not really supposed to see them, like, being sexual with one another or anything. It's kind of all, like, underlying their feelings. And so just, like, having these kind of intimate shots or long pauses where there's only music, like, I feel like it just gives, like, another level of depth to their relationship.
Mm-hmm.
I read that, like, Wong Kar-wai purposefully kind of put, like, stuff in front of the camera in, like, almost every shot because he wanted this, like, obstruction to make the audience feel like one yeah. of the neighbors kind of, like, watching in on the couple.
Yeah.
I think that was, like, really well achieved. Mm, like, yeah. super well done.
Yeah, and it makes you feel even more a part of it because, yeah, there's, like, obstructions between you and them, but also, like, between them. Like, they've got mm-hmm. this massive barrier. If you haven't seen the film, like I said, it's Wong Kar-wai. It came out in 2000, but it's set in Hong Kong, 1962. Two married people move into the same apartment with their spouses, but the spouses are often absent. They're not there. We never actually, like, see the spouses' faces. Mm-hmm, yeah. Either of their, like, we can kind of see the back of them move, but, like, their full body's never in the frame throughout the whole thing. And they're very absent. And then these two characters find out that their respective spouses are having an affair with each other. And so obviously, like, the fact that they're married in the first place is a massive block if they were ever going to get together, like, without their spouses having an affair. But then on top of that, there's the layers that they're people that they're supposed to love and feel loved by are cheating on them, like, with the other person. Yeah. So it's also complicated, but that's obviously a big barrier for them to get together if they mm-hmm. do love each other in that way.
Yeah, and I feel like the, like, kind of start of that relationship in that way maybe came about as their, like, exploration of, like, how they imagine their partners ended up getting together and having this affair. Mm-hmm. And I feel like a lot of the dialogue around their conversations in these scenarios where they're talking about, like, cheating or, like, confessing love or something, and then it turns out they were talking, like, they were role-playing what they believe yeah. their partners to have done. Yeah. And so, like, I feel like that just is, like, a super interesting way to have two characters constantly be interacting and communicating when you're supposed to kind of imagine these two characters as the ones falling in love when they're reflecting on their partners who had been cheating on them.
Mm-hmm. And the fact that they don't end up together.
No. Yeah.
Which I don't know. I guess that's what we were also talking about with one of our other friends after watching it, that, like, yeah, this is described as, like, one of the best. If you're gonna see a movie about love or romance, like, this is really important. And I do agree that it's really important, but it's just not what you expect because it's also so lonely and so sad mm-hmm. that they end up the way that they do mm-hmm. and have those barriers for being with each other of, because do they want to be with each other? Like,
I don't know. Like, I don't know. Like, is it that it was kind of, like, circumstantial? Like, because their partners got together, they formed this bond and they fell in love? Or yeah, was, like, it always going to be meant to be? Like, you don't kind of know. It's kind of left up there.
Yeah. which I do like that. It's just hard.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You can appreciate it with still finding it so hard.
Mm-hmm.
Because, yeah, would they connect on such a level if they didn't have this, like, complete common ground? But they also do have all these common things, like their interests and
yeah,
their, like,
food. Writing.
Yeah. And, like, having food together, mm-hmm. which is shown as such, like, a way to connect for mm-hmm. them as well. So, yeah, I guess you never know. It's a lot up in the air, but that it's true. It does make it more special, and it's a bit maybe more of a lesson than just, like, a you get a happy ending out of it.
Yeah, like, I definitely feel like rom-coms are obviously you always end feeling good.
Mm-hmm.
And I really appreciate that form of movie, like, as a representation of love for, like, everything good that can come out of it.
Mm-hmm.
But I also feel like movies like In the Mood for Love or some of the other ones we're going to talk about are also so important to just kind of show, like, it's not always going to end up perfectly, but that's okay. Like, everyone will still move on with their lives. Like, you can be content in your decisions and still reflect on these past experiences you've had.
Yeah, I agree. And I think that's so important because you really can't, coming from my, I've got a lot of, I'm 19 years old, you know, I've lived through a lot.
She's lived a life, guys.
No joke at all. But, like, yeah, you can't, at least what I got from it, obviously, like you said, Mia, rom-coms, like, you get that hit of, like, what's so fun about love, but you don't get that whole aspect that love does not exist without, like, feelings of not being loved. Like, it's not just some consistent road where, like, you get it,
mm-hmm.
but it's, the movie is just as much about finding love as it is about not feeling loved and not feeling desired,
mm-hmm.
and those go hand in hand because, like, yeah, the next chapter starts once, like, one romantic connection ends, that kind of thing. So I think, yeah, I completely think that's so important.
Yeah, like the ambiguity and the sort of like open-ended, never fully resolved nature.
Yeah, it's kind of bittersweet.
Like, yeah, it kind of like mirrors real life, I guess, in a way. Like you never, like very rarely are you getting like a very solid like relationship, beginning relationship, like end. Like it's all like cut and dry.
Mm-hmm.
Like there's still, I guess, like the idea that like the love was there. And even if it's not still here, it matters that it existed, I guess.
Yeah.
It's kind of explored, but
And even if they don't know where it went or not exactly what went wrong, but just like things that didn't happen and things that weren't said, it kind of tells you, I guess, that it's okay that the audience doesn't know. When I was kind of confused about the scene with him in the wall.
That was the thing where he was talking with a friend about that old legend that you can tell a secret into a wall and then bury it forever and it'll remain untouched. And like
right. So he stands there and we assume that he's saying all these things that you kind of want to hear him say on screen because that's your expectation as a viewer. But he says all them and then he shoves this mud in the hole to block it off. And there, it's gone. Like, we don't get to hear it and they don't need to know it.
Yeah, it's kind of, I feel like I interpret it as just like a way that he can be at peace with himself and his decision to move to, it was Taiwan, I believe.
Mm-hmm. I forget.
Yeah, somewhere. He moved somewhere. And how that's okay. And he can be content in that decision and how he can reflect on it. But he also has to move on at some point.
Yeah.
And that's why he, like, did that whole ceremony, I guess, in my mind at least.
Yeah.
But, yeah. That's why I think, like, that final, like, 3 to 5 minute shot of kind of just that temple area and him telling the wall his secrets.
Yeah.
Like, it's just really impactful to me for the movie because I don't think it would have been as significant to me if it kind of just turned out that they got to live happily ever together. It wouldn't have been it would have been more satisfying maybe on the surface, but like at a deeper level, like you want to see things that don't always pan out the way you think they will just based on like the media. Like this is a more accurate representation of what would probably happen in a scenario like this.
Yeah. And you also, you want to learn something sometimes. Sometimes you don't want to have to think. And that's when you watch anyone but you. But sometimes you can think and you can also learn something from it, I guess. But yeah, let's get a song going from this is, you might recognize it. It plays every 2 minutes in the movie.
If you guys watch Chungking Express, he also does that same thing with California Dreaming, like every 5 minutes. It's like his thing. He loves to play a song over and over and over again.
Yeah, well, it grew on me. It was like beginning, love it. Middle, please turn this off. And there we go again, like a familiar sound.
Yeah.
So this is called, I'm not exactly sure if I'm going to pronounce this right, but Yumeji's theme. So here we are. Okay. So that just wrapped up our conversation on In the Mood for Love, which, like I said, we all watched at the beer garden. So there will probably be another beer garden that we haven't announced happening next month. We usually do one once a month where we sell beer, which we don't usually do at our double features. So yeah, you should come out for that at the Norm. Anyway, let's move on to our next film on our little theme about romance movies. Yeah. So Emma, do you want to introduce the film you want to talk
Absolutely.
About?
Absolutely. So I'm going to be talking about But I'm a Cheerleader, which is a 1999 satirical rom-com by Jamie Babbitt. And I watched this film for the first time probably like last summer, and I loved it. It was so well done. Like, there's this weird 90s period where they're just like pumping out like all these absurdist movies like Bill and Ted and like this one, where it's just like, this is like these crazy sort of movies that aren't really grounded in reality. And I love absurdism. It is so much fun, one of my favorite genres. So getting to see this, it was like so cool to see this represented on screen in such a unique way. Mm-hmm. And something that's cool about this movie is that it is queer. It is the main relationship is between Megan, and who's played by Natasha Lyonne. And why am I blanking on the other girl's name?
It's played by someone, Clea Duvall.
I'm forgetting her name. Oh, hold on, let me do a cheeky Google.
But this is, she meets this other person when she's put in the conversion.
Yes. Graham. So it is between Megan and Graham. And yeah, so basically this movie follows Megan, who's a cheerleader who was sent to a camp to cure her so-called lesbianism. Well, there she realized that she is in fact a lesbian and falls in love with one of the other girls there. Mm-hmm. So it kind of has this like, this political message that at the time wasn't really being talked about very much, mm-hmm. which kind of like just how out there it was with this message kind of led to it getting a bit of, like, panned from the critics. And that came back a few years later with a bit of a cult following. And as mm-hmm. like the 21st century started to get underway, people looked back at it and began to reevaluate how they felt about it and realized that it was actually a really good satire. And I think this is just so excellently well done, because the director, Jamie Babbitt, on directing this, she said that she wanted to create a lesbian love story where they don't kill each other or someone dies, which is just so prevalent in like major like queer works. So if you think about like even ones in like the 21st century, like think about like Brokeback Mountain or Portrait of a Lady on Fire, like those are not happy movies.
No.
And like we're moving towards more like happy queer sort of content, like with Heartstopper and that sort of thing. But at the time, like, there wasn't a lot of it to be seen. So this kind of, like, bubbly, strange, absurdist little movie was very out of place in, like, the culture of the time, feels like. And, yeah, I think it has a lot of the fun, like, sort of rom-com trappings. Like, there's this, like, big confession at the end.
Yeah.
It's all these little, like, yeah, micro, like, tropes. And it's really just such a fun movie.
It's so interesting about films that, like, when they're like, when this first came out in the box office, like, they didn't even like it that much. And nowadays, like, yeah, I'm surprised to hear that, because it's got such a cult following. Yeah. Like, we had it play at the Norm, and, like, yeah, massive group of people. It's got a following now, and you wouldn't think that at the time people weren't interested or critics were saying this and that. But it just depends, what time, when it's coming out, and then, like, what recircles it back and, like, what message kind of comes back a few years later or a decade later. I'm blanking on the other films that I feel like I've heard of other ones like that, but it's interesting.
Oh, yeah.
It kind of had a stat, like, cast, too, right? Yeah. Like, the cast, isn't RuPaul in it?
RuPaul is.
That was so crazy when I found out about that. I haven't seen it, but I read all about his character.
It's crazy. Like, RuPaul's just casually in the movie. You're like, oh my God, like, that's entirely RuPaul. That's
and he's
crazy.
Not just in the movie, he's in the movie as supposedly a reformed.
Yeah.
Like, he's ex-gay.
Yeah.
And then he's working at the camp that's trying to convert these supposedly gay kids
to
be straight.
Yeah.
Which is so funny.
That's like, yeah, there's a lot of that sort of like just irony within the film that kind of comes out the more you look into it, which I think is like really cool.
Yeah.
Because on like writing the script, Brian Wayne Peterson, who wrote the script, he said that he wanted the script to entertain, but to also encourage people to talk about the issues kind of raised by it, which I think this definitely does, because it's very like light and poppy and keeps a light tone. But like, the undertones of the movie are very, like, heavy.
Yeah, and you don't want to miss the point. Like, the point is, like, the dangers of conversion camps and things like that.
Yeah.
And all of, like, the harmful stereotypes. And so making it a fun movie to watch doesn't mean that, like, you have to miss out on all of the deeper meanings and, like, the lessons. Because that would just be, hopefully that's not what was happening at the beginning. Maybe people were just missing the point or something.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I still have to see it. I don't even know where to find it on, though. Did you watch it on the big screen?
I didn't. I think I got it from, like, the library or something.
And ooh, the library?
Yeah, I love the library.
No, I really respect that. Like, let's bring that back.
You've never done that in your life.
Yeah. Are you kidding me? Wait, I was not saying I've done that before, but I have.
Oh, you do respect it.
I do respect
it. But you don't do it.
I do respect it. I say we should bring that back. Like, okay. I loved old DVD stores and going and picking out your movies for the week.
Yeah.
Did you not do that?
No.
Wow. Well,
no.
You missed out on a core childhood experience.
I gotta get to the library.
I also feel like Natasha Lyonne, her playing a lead in this movie, and she's like such like a quintessential like 90s, 2000s, like, it girl in my mind. Like, she is so cool. So for like for her to like be in this kind of role, just like, I feel like that would also kind of make the movie like, wow, like show people that like, wow, like really popular actresses and actors are acting in this movie that's like kind of on like a controversial topic at the time.
Yeah.
And it's kind of just like a cool representation in a way of like how you can make a movie about queer love stories and topics, and it will like be go to the box office, like it will make money, like eventually at least.
Eventually. And our fave girl Michelle Williams, isn't it?
She is.
Yes.
Oh yes, I did. I do know that actually. Oh my god.
As Kimberly.
Oh yeah.
Do you recall that?
I do recall.
Is she
that.
Also a cheerleader?
I think so.
Because I know she plays someone called Kimberly, character. But I don't know who Kimberly is.
She definitely is playing like one of those quaint, quiet little like schoolgirl roles.
No,
like she's so
she
good.
She doesn't
at those.
Always do that.
Oh my god, what movie does she like not do that in? She's always a quiet, shy girl.
No, she's so sassy in Dawson's Creek.
Okay, Dawson's Creek is the exception.
Yeah, she comes from the city because she's like always going so crazy.
Oh,
in the
yeah,
city. Like,
okay.
That's her whole shtick.
I'm just thinking of like Blue Valentine, Manchester by the Sea.
Yeah, she
like
is
all her other
quiet,
sad, quiet movies.
Yeah.
Yeah, she is a cheerleader in this, like a minor cheerleader. She doesn't even have that big of a role.
Yeah.
Just like crazy stacked cast, though. Like,
yeah.
Kind of insane how many people they had in this, but. Yeah, I love But I'm a Cheerleader. I highly recommend checking it out. I think it's a pretty quick watch.
Soundtrack looks cool, too.
Soundtrack
hey?
Is so good, yeah. No, I adore every aspect of this movie.
So the song that you wanted to play from it is called Chick Habit.
Yes.
By April March. April March? What a name.
Sounds crazy. Like a Little Women inspired or something.
Or like too
seasons.
Many seasons.
I thought it went away over my head. I was like,
no, that was so true. Little Women, coded. Do you remember which part of the film that it plays at?
The very opening.
The very
sequence.
Opening one.
Yeah,
okay.
It's like the first song.
They're
you
tossing
in
the cheerleaders.
Yeah.
Ooh.
Okay. Cool.
Peppy.
Let's play it properly this time.
You're gonna see the reason why when this bit
That was cute. I like that song. And me and Mia are on our way to watch But I'm a Cheerleader, basically right after right this, because now. We're completely convinced. Yeah, episode's ending early. See you guys. Anyway, no, just kidding. Don't change. Don't change.
Not click off.
Don't click off. We're moving on. We're moving on from But I'm a Cheerleader. Again, you're listening to CITR 101.9 FM, and this is The Real World, the UBC Film Society's radio segment. We're talking all things kind of related to Valentine's Day, so we're doing rom-coms, romance, dramas, things like that. But we're going to let Mia take the reins on this one and start us off on a couple new films we're going to talk about. First, let's do the Before trilogy you wanted to talk about.
Yes, one of my favorite trilogies. This is.
Do you have other trilogies on your list?
Sorry. Anything. I can't do anything.
I'm just kidding.
Okay, so the Before trilogy, directed entirely, all three movies, by Richard Linklater, is comprised of three movies: Before Sunrise, Before Sunset, and then Before Midnight. And it follows the love story of these two characters, Jesse and Celine, played by Ethan Hawke, love of my life, and Julie Delpy. Yeah. And so this movie is kind of more along the lines of In the Mood for Love, I would say, and kind of like not necessarily your typical run-of-the-mill happy love story necessarily.
Yeah.
But the first movie, it follows basically the entire span of a night or Before Sunrise.
Yeah.
In Venice?
Vienna.
Vienna. I knew it was a V name.
She knew.
And it just follows these two characters who coincidentally have a cute little meet cute on a train.
Inside. They stole that. They stole that from It Happened One Night. No offense, but they just changed the vehicle. Anyway, carry on.
And they just spend the day together, just walking through the city, interacting with different people, kind of just interacting with the city in a way that I feel like I had not seen portrayed in film before.
Mm-hmm.
But I watched that movie probably 2 or 3 years ago. Mm-hmm. And then last year in Introduction to Film Studies, shout out, we watched Cleo from 5 to 7 by Agnes Varda, which I loved. And I can really see the influence that the Before trilogy took from this movie, because it also follows the main love interest character kind of just throughout her day in the city.
Yeah, like real time.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And it just feels like really, like this trilogy feels really real. Like it just feels like you're there watching two people that could be anybody, mm-hmm. normal people interacting and talking about the things that you think about, mm-hmm. and like the things that you wonder about, like life and love and human connection. And I don't know. I just think it's a really beautifully done movie that has a lot of like real aspects of it was the right person, but maybe not like wrong time. And then how it kind of leaves it up in the air at the end of the movie if they do end up meeting up again.
Right.
And their planned 6-monthly like reunion.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. They end up saying their first like, have you seen it?
No, I haven't.
Oh, okay. So I'm just jumping in.
So they meet each other on the train, whatever.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They spend the afternoon and evening before sunrise in Vienna.
Mm-hmm.
And then they say they'll like meet in a year, but then they're like, no, a year's too long.
Yeah.
Let's meet back at this train station
in
6 months from today, mm-hmm. like at this time.
Fatal flaw. They don't exchange contact information, no
mailing
address.
That's the romantic part about it. They're like, let's just let this night sit perfectly in our minds. They don't like take pictures of each other or anything like that. They take mental pictures, like the way to live. And then they're like, let's not say we're gonna call or keep in touch, because it is true, like, yeah, I like that part that they're like, that always happens when you like, even if you make like a new friend and stuff like that, it's so often like these huge commitments, like, okay, but we'll FaceTime every Sunday, mm-hmm. like things like that. They're not like that. They're not having this like hopeless romantic thing, even though they are hopeless romantics. They both admit, like, especially she is, and that comes back later in the trilogy where she's like, oh, I had all these ideas when she's reading. Well, we'll get to that. Anyway, they kind of leave it up in the air of whether they will or will not meet each other in 6 months, and then the movie ends. But we get another one.
Yeah, I really like that it became a trilogy and that we do get to see what the intended results of that proposition were. But mm-hmm. I also like how the movie leaves you wondering at the end. Like, so in that, I don't know how many years it was, like 8-year gap between, 8 or 9-year gap between the first two movies, you're kind of like wondering, like, did they end up meeting up? And it's kind of just like a, aw, like, you hope they did. And then it turns out in Before Sunset, they did not.
What?
But they meet again. It's about, I don't know how many years later this one is set. Is it set in, anyways, they meet up later.
It's a few years.
It's a significant amount of time. Yeah. Jesse, played by Ethan Hawke, has a son. And he is a successful author. Oh. And he's written about,
I would say it's like 7 or 8 years old. Because I think the son, when he goes and find they meet again, is 5 years old.
Okay,
and
that makes sense to me.
He had to like get married and everything. But like the movies are shot over just under 10 years.
Yeah.
Which, like, no one does it like Linklater.
No, actually, like, he was on a mission.
He was on a mission. And then, like, have you guys seen Boyhood?
No. I haven't, but I really want
to. So that's also spanning about 10 years with the, like, one
kid. That's crazy.
Oh, my God.
And it's just, yeah, I was trying to think of the other. I was like, what else have I seen that's the same kind of thing that you get this commitment from these same actors and they keep coming back and it's another Linklater film? Yeah. Like, yeah, no one else does it like he does. It's so special to see them, like, not change actors or anything like that. It would not be the
aging
same.
Aging authentically.
Yeah.
Like, it's not weird prosthetics or kind of, like, unrealistic changes that it's like, wow, they haven't aged a day and it's been 10 years or whatever. Like, you're seeing the authentic progression of a person's life.
Yeah.
And so, in Before Sunset, which is my personal favorite out of the trilogy.
Yeah, I was
going to
say, that one's your favorite.
Yeah. They meet back up at a bookstore, coincidentally, because Ethan, or Hawke's character, Jesse, was doing a book signing. And Celine, she read the book. She read about their night together that he wrote about. He included her in the book.
Wow.
And she goes, kind of stumbles upon the library, and she's kind of hesitant as to if she wants to see him again. And then they get to talking about if they did go back to the train station those 6 months later, and it turns out he did, but she didn't.
Oh, my God.
But he lies at first, and he says he also didn't.
Yeah.
But
don't believe anything he says.
Then they just spend the day again, like, before sunset, walking, taxiing, hanging around on
takes,
boats.
Like, a special, I don't know if anyone here just, like, likes literally watching day-to-day stuff occur. Like, that can get so boring. Like, it takes a special filmmaker to, like, make a real-time thing still so interesting.
Yeah.
Because obviously day-to-day life is interesting. There's beautiful things and the little things, but also no one wants to sit and watch a movie of nothing happening. Yeah. And in theory, like, not a lot happens. They stay in the same city for both of these.
It's just these two characters interacting. They don't have interactions with other characters really throughout the movie.
But their chemistry is so good. The writing is so good. It's all so beautiful to watch anyway. They're both so attractive. Like, there's enough factors that, like, it's entirely, like, you don't lose your train of thought because you're just watching someone kind of move around throughout their day. Like, and I think it's also helpful that they're both always in unfamiliar places to them.
Yeah.
Like, you're not in their home moving around with them. So it's a little bit, like, it's not just interesting to the viewer. It's a little bit interesting to them as well. Like, they're exploring somewhere new.
Yeah. But I was just going to say, I saw an interview with Julie Depley after, I think, during the filming of the second movie, so Before Sunset, and she comments on how a lot of people think there's aspects of improv within the movies because it's such, like, an organic film. Like, it really feels like they're just two people talking and there happened to be a camera. But she explains how actually every single movement, every single glance, every single touch or not touch, like, is orchestrated and written by the writers, and just how good they are at communicating their feelings that these two characters are experiencing so naturally, even though
so
it's entirely orchestrated.
Like, every stutter or, like, little look away, or
it's crazy.
They kind of seem to start blushing or something. Like, everything is there and it feels so natural.
Oh, my God.
That's the same thing that happens in The Office, by the way. Something I read about that as well. That, like, just, but it's true. Like, stuff that seems so day to day and, like, potentially mundane, like, in The Office and the Before trilogy, it's all so specific, like, every little bit.
So Pam and Jim coded.
But did you know that, like, oh my God, that Linklater, like, he based it off of a woman that he met?
Yeah.
Oh my God.
So he met her in, like, a store, and then he basically was like, I only have one night here, whatever. They, like, talked, got to know each other, and then, like, that was it. And then apparently while he was kind of on this one night only date, the same thing that happens in the movies, he told this girl in real life, I want to like make a film about this, like about this feeling that we're having right now. Oh my God.
Imagine if that was you. That I would love that.
That's crazy that he said that. Anyway, and then he goes off and does it and was hoping that she would come to the premiere. And you could see all of these things like come into play in the films. Like, I didn't know like how much, I obviously don't know how much of the personality of Jesse's character is based off of, but like that hoping that like maybe she'll turn up, that writing a story about the girl that you met for only one night, but just like having still such a feeling, like such a strong feeling that it can make up a whole book.
Yeah.
Or a whole movie.
And then I guess the second movie ends on a more hopeful, inspiring, love-driven note where Jesse ends up missing his flight home. And it kind of ends with them just in her, or maybe it's his apartment. Either way, they're together still. And they're like, like, we should give this another shot. Like, we obviously, there's something here we have to explore.
Yeah.
So then, transition, Before Midnight, the third movie in the trilogy. This movie was the hardest for me to get through, I think, just because it's kind of different than the first two. Because it, now you flash forward, they're married. They have two daughters. And they're going on a vacation to this little...
They're at like a villa where he's doing this like writer's kind of workshop. Like they're staying with a professional writer type thing. So they're there the whole summer.
But yeah, basically this movie follows just kind of the aspects of their relationship and the conflicts that arise within it. And kind of just like, I guess it's just like the typical trope of two people falling in love, getting married, and then like maybe like the spark is starting to die, or there's questions about... like the love they have for each other. And this movie is just really intense, but it's really good at like just being organic representation of like couples and like different representations of love and how love grows with someone and how it changes throughout someone's life. And so while this movie is really sad at times, and there's this funny Letterboxd review that I liked, credit to whoever this person was, that says, "I screamed, please stop fighting at my screen 8 billion times during this." And I was like, that's literally so true. I did that too. Because it's just so intense and emotional and raw that it's like you feel like you're like sitting there watching them fight. And you're just like, no, you guys love each other. Please stop fighting.
Yeah.
But yeah.
Oh my God. I think I was the most in awe of the third movie. This is like, have you been, are you convinced to watch these yet?
I have. I've been convinced. I got reading week now.
Okay.
You have time.
Can you,
Can you please? Yeah. We'll do a trade off. We'll watch, But I'm a Cheerleader.
Yeah. But yeah, I was so in awe of this movie. Like every, the third, which I guess surprised me. I thought it was going to teeter off, but the writing was so good. And just the way that it just, they kind of go up and down through their arguments and like things come up and then they're able to like resolve it a little bit, and then so, and then someone comes back with a little remark. Like it just felt so real. It feels again like they're improvising, but they're not. And yeah, the other thing about it, it just like, there are twinges of this in the first two movies, but something that if done well is so fun to me is when the characters aren't that likable to you.
Yeah.
And I love that. Like in the first two, okay, they're kind of like pretentious and they bother me a couple times. I'm like, oh my God, you guys are all cute and everything, but if I met you in real life, like I do find they're so like trying to say philosophical things, like, and like stuff like that, which is like romantic for a romantic movie, but it gets to be a lot. And then this movie just takes it to a whole new level. The third of the three, God, they're so unlikable at certain points. But yeah, I think if it's done in a way that's like almost makes you think I've met someone like that or something like that, so incredible. Like such a weird feeling of like hating them and wanting to yell at the screen, but being like, wow, someone actually was able to capture that feeling of like the fight, or being so annoyed with people who are fighting, or being in a fight with someone and like it being so unproductive.
Yeah. And just like, I feel like that movie is just so, I don't want to say inspiring, but it's just like, it was inspiring how they can have such intense fights in times of conflict, like within the family setting, within their relationships, like setting, within like work settings, that are just so realistic to have. But then it still comes together. And like, at the end of the day, like, it's a realistic, like, not big, profession of like love through a big act at the end. Like he just sits down again and he reintroduces himself when they're sitting on the water.
Yeah.
And it kind of just rounds back out to the beginning of just like
the love is still there. Yeah. Like no matter what.
I have a quote from Ethan Hawke when he was talking about the trilogy. He was reflecting on it in an interview with The Guardian. And he says, the first film is about what it could be. The second is about what it should have been. And Before Midnight is about what it is. And I think about that quote so many times a day because, wow, like, I don't think there's a better way to sum it up. That literally is.
That's so devastating. That's
life. Like, yeah, like, wow.
Yeah, that's so weird when something's like so inspiring, but also like, wow.
Like, oh God. Like, I watched that movie and I was like, oh, well, wow.
This is what we have.
Yeah, I was like, okay, looking forward to this.
Yeah, but it's also like, how lucky would you be to like literally have that in store? Yeah, still, like, because they love each other so much. Yeah, I don't know. I think about this a lot too. Like, it's a real struggle of whether like love hate with their characters and their relationships.
Yeah.
But we chose one song from the trilogy that is featured in Before Sunrise, the first of the three, by Kath Bloom. It's called Come Here. One of my favorite scenes. Best scene, I think, in the first.
Oh, by far. The first movie.
And just, I think it represents, yeah, what we were kind of talking about earlier. We've kind of teetered back and forth between films that a lot of talking, a lot of, like, not doing.
This, like, combines it.
This combines it.
Mm-hmm. And it's just, like, them in the record store listening to this song, their glances at one another.
They don't meet each other's eye once. They don't say anything. Mm-hmm. They're just wait out the, like, basically entirety of the song, like, right next to each other, shoulder to shoulder. And they keep looking at each other, but they, like, never meet eyes. It's incredible.
If you don't want to watch this movie, at least watch this clip.
Yeah. Okay, well, here's the song that plays in the clip.
There's a wind that blows in from the north, and it says that loving takes its course. Come here, come here. No, I'm not impossible to touch. I have never wanted you so much.
Okay, Cool. That was a song from Before Sunrise, because we just chatted about the Before trilogy, one of Mia's favorite trilogy. She has a lot of different favorite trilogies. It's kind of her niche. She doesn't watch movies unless they're a part of a trilogy.
If they don't have more than one, not there.
They're out.
Not there.
But yeah, thanks for tuning in. We talked a lot about romance movies. We'll never do it again. We swear.
No more love.
We're doing rapid fire this or that to finish off the episode. Emma, you're answering even if you haven't seen it. Just go based off vibes.
Great.
Because Emma's not our resident romance movie fanatic. Unfortunately, we're trying to get her on board, but she's not there yet. Just go based on vibes, though.
Got it.
Okay. How to Lose a Guy in 10 Days or 10 Things I Hate About You?
10 Things I Hate About You.
10 Things I Hate About You.
Okay, 10 Things I Hate About You or 13 Going on 30?
10 Things I Hate About You.
10 Things I Hate About You or Love, Rosie?
10 Things I Hate About You.
10 Things I Hate About You or 500 Days of Summer?
500 Days of Summer.
Oh, no, we've diverted for the first time. Okay, 500 Days of Summer or one day? 500 Days of Summer.
Yeah, I've never heard of one day, so 500 Days
of
Summer.
Okay, so we've... Okay, Emma's taking a turn. 500 Days of Summer or... The Notebook?
500 Days of Summer.
The Notebook.
Oh, okay.
Ryan Gosling.
A classic. Yeah.
Let's go The Notebook or Before Sunset.
Before Sunset.
Before Sunset or Before Sunrise.
Before Sunset.
Before Sunset or Before Midnight.
Before Sunset. That's my favorite. I already said that.
Before Sunset or About Time.
About Time.
About Time or Atonement.
Oh my God. Atonement.
Atonement or Pride and Prejudice?
Atonement.
Pride and Prejudice.
Okay. So those were our top two. Pride and Prejudice and Atonement. We didn't talk about that at all today, but that's what we finished off on.
This
maybe
is
we'll
all
do
you need.
Period pieces next time.
Oh my God.
Okay. Thanks for listening. See you guys in 2 weeks.
Thanks
hopefully.
For having me, Lily.
Yeah, of course.
Damn.